This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think the people in Block Island are really going to make out. I mean, their electricity was probably 3 to 4 times what the average ratepayer pays in Rhode Island. So they're going to see a big savings right away.
As the public learned of the recent opening of America's first offshore wind power project, many wondered why it took so long. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk with the executive editor of EcoRI News, Tim Faulkner, to discuss the opening of the Block Island Wind Farm off of Rhode Island. We learn about the logistics of this undertaking, compare it to offshore wind projects in Europe, and ponder the future of similar endeavors under a presidential administration that's openly hostile to wind power. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the executive editor of EcoRI News, Tim Faulkner. Tim, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here.
There's been some big news coming out of your state, Rhode Island, in the environmental space. The country's first offshore wind farm just opened up off of Block Island. Why don't you explain the importance of this to our listeners around the country?
Well, it's significant for Rhode Island and for the country, really, because it's the first ever offshore wind farm. It's a tiny one. It's only 5 wind turbines, but it's a big, long process to get offshore and even onshore wind turbines built. So as the first ever in the U.S., it really went through a long process with a lot of inexperienced people and processes to get it approved. So, you know, it took a long time, but I think that there's a lot of promise within, you know, the East Coast in particular, that there's going to be much, much more of this kind of development and more renewable energy.
And the Deepwater Wind Company, which is running this farm, how have they been able to approach some of the pushback from the NIMBYism that often crops up when we talk about wind farms, people who don't want it in their backyards?
I think the key to getting a permit was that they went through a process with the state. They created something called the Ocean Special Area Management Plan. And so with one of the state agencies called the Coastal Resources Management Commission, what they did is they went ahead and laid out the whole process for how this would happen. First, they designated the area offshore where they could build the wind turbines. So they, you know, there's an area, a region that is off of, you know, still in state waters where they thought it would be suitable to have wind. And then they put together a whole process for how the permitting would get approved. And that would include a lot of public vetting and public meetings. So that really laid the groundwork. Once those rules were passed and in place, then the developer, like Deepwater Wind, knew exactly how to go about it and how to get it done. So that, you know, because there was a lot of, I think, opportunity for public input in that ocean SAMP process, that all the other siting after that went pretty smoothly. I mean, there were a few hiccups along the way, but there was no massive public pushback that maybe you would see like on the Cape Wind project, because this laid out for how it could happen. And so that, you know, that really was, I think, one of the key pieces to making it move forward.
I'm glad you mentioned the Cape Wind project, because that was my next question. Maybe you can spell out some of the differences. Rhode Island and Cape Cod are actually fairly close as the crow flies, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah. You know, they were similar. I think that they were both pretty close to shore. The Cape Wind project, I think, was kind of 4 miles off of Cape Cod and probably about the same distance to Nantucket. And the Block Island Wind Farm is about a little over 3 miles offshore. So I think in that sense, they're pretty similar, but I think it was really helped for the Block Island Wind Project was that it was only 5 turbines, whereas the Cape Wind project, I think I've seen estimates where it was as many as 130 turbines. So I think trying to be the first offshore wind project and doing one of that size really put it at a disadvantage. I think that you've got that much more real estate of people that could speak up and be opposed to it, including a lot of fishing and recreational boating that happens in that area off of Cape Cod. I mean, that's a really busy trafficked area for recreational boating and for commercial fishing. So they just, I think they really had a big uphill battle for trying to get that done. And as well, they didn't have a designated wind area like they had off of Rhode Island. There's also federal wind areas that have been created, but that wasn't part of it as well. They really didn't have the power purchase agreement that the Deepwater Wind Project had. And so I think it was really the size of it and the fact that they didn't have all the financing in place, and the location really sewed up that the project just didn't have much of a chance.
So is that completely dead, the Cape Wind Project?
It really feels like it is. I think when the developer, every few months, you see an article that says that he insists that it's still not dead. But the power purchase agreement, which is essentially the agreement between the electric utility and the wind project to buy the electricity, that fell apart, I think, last year. And without that, you're really not going to get the financial backing. You're not going to get the investors for the project. And so without any of that, it doesn't feel like that there's much opportunity for that project to go forward, at least not, in the next year or two.
So explain how these power purchase agreements work when we're talking about a body of water. How does a company get approval to lay these large turbines in the middle of the ocean? As you said, Cape Cod is a very active boating and fishing area, but so is Block Island, Rhode Island. There's Race Week there, which is a very famous sailing week. My family actually had a house in Block Island when I was growing up, so this is a story near and dear to my heart. I'm interested in seeing these turbines one day. But how does it work in terms of logistics? It sounds a little tricky. I mean, how would a boat know that they're about to enter this area?
Yeah, it is complicated. And again, I think the geographics of it, although, the area around Block Island, at least most of it, is open ocean, whereas the land between Nantucket and Cape Cod, that's Cape Cod Sound. So that's, I think, just a busier area that has a lot of different types of traffic. I think there's even probably a commercial freighter traffic that goes through there as well. So I think it's just one that's much more highly visible. The Block Island project is off the southeast corner of the island, so it's probably the one that's the least trafficked, and it doesn't create a big disruption. Even I think at this point they're showing that having the foundations in the water is attracting fish, so it's probably caused some of the fishermen to sort of back off a little bit because they're very leery of these projects. But the logistics are complicated because not only do you have to put the turbines in, you've got to, come up with some pretty sizable foundations, and you've got to either put in these large cement, foundations on the ocean floor, or you have to pile drive, and that creates a whole nother set of problems. And on top of that, then you have to create the transmission line, which will go to the mainland. And, that can be hundreds of miles long, and that can go through federal waters and through state waters, and a whole lot of permitting is required to do that. And then getting that, in the case with the Block Island project, they had to tie that in to Narragansett, Rhode Island, which is a big recreation and beach community, and that created some problems as well. So, yeah, it is complicated, and getting all those pieces together, it takes a lot of time and a lot of different stakeholders that you have to work with.
How much does an organization like Deepwater Wind have to work with a compliant federal government? You have Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, who's a progressive Democrat, and he's co-founder of the Senate Climate Action Task Force. I mean, this is somebody who obviously believes in clean energy, but the president coming in, he who shall not be named, has clashed with wind power projects in the past, most notoriously in Scotland, where he has a golf course, and he didn't want those turbines ruining the view for the golfers. How much will federal support or lack of support play a role in wind projects like this moving forward?
I think that a lot of that remains to be seen. The Block Island project was probably helped that I think only a mile or two of it went through federal waters. So there wouldn't have been an opportunity, I think, for at the federal level to put a complete stop to it.
When you say only a mile, how many miles is a five turbine footprint?
Well, it's getting that transmission line from the site of the turbines to the mainland.
I see.
That was the line that delivers the electricity to the mainland that was the one that, you know, travels through different waters.
All right. So sorry, I interrupted you about the role of federal regulations and subsidies.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've been to meetings recently, and I think there's some questions about what the federal participation can do to these projects going forward. What they've done along the East Coast, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the federal agency, has, I don't know if they're an agency, but they're part of maybe the Department of Energy, but they have created these designated wind development areas. So there's one that's about, I don't know, 1,200 square miles that's to the south of both Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And there's a few of these areas along New York and along the Northeast where they're already set aside for wind energy development. So the siting would not necessarily be a problem for building the turbines since these lands are already designated. Now, maybe those permits can be pulled or these designations can be pulled. But in the past, and maybe you're seeing some of these being announced ahead of the inauguration, but you're starting to see announcements like there was, I think, Monday in Massachusetts, between a Danish wind developer and Eversource, one of the electric utilities in Massachusetts, that they're going to build a wind farm in this designated wind area off of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. And there's a couple other projects that have also been announced previously. So I think if these projects are already moving forward, it might be tough to pull them back, especially since there already is a wind farm and they're creating jobs and there's new companies that have set up in Rhode Island and along the coast that are designed to help these projects get built. So, I think it still remains to be seen, but I think that this industry is getting some pretty good footing, and to try and really shut it down or reverse course might be a challenge.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once. Never, never, never.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Tim Faulkner. He's the executive editor of EcoRI News. So you mentioned how the Block Island wind farm is relatively small. It only has five turbines. But this is the first one in the U.S. If you look down the list of what European countries have been doing in terms of offshore wind, it's pretty staggering to compare. I mean, there are literally dozens of offshore wind projects that Siemens and other big companies like Odwen, and Vestas, these are the three big ones. Most of their turbines are in the 50 to 175 turbine range, and they're all off of Germany, UK, Denmark, Belgium. The only one that's not in Europe of this size is China, and that's a six-year-old project. Is there a chance for the U.S. to start making inroads similar to Europe? What's been the secret to the success for the Europeans in terms of offshore wind technology?
Well, I think that they've benefited really from subsidies, and they have higher electricity prices in Europe than they do in the U.S. So the fact that they're paying for more for electricity and for renewable energy as it is, that it's more there's a much bigger cost benefit to building these projects. I think there are other incentives that they're offered as well to get them built, as a lot of countries are trying to really aggressively push their renewable portfolios to include wind energy. So I think there's been that the cost incentive is in place there. And so they just started earlier, and they mapped out the cost process to do it. And so that's why I think we're behind. But I think we've got one thing that we have to our advantage is that we've got these areas, just like the one off of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, that are perfect. The wind speed is exactly what you want. The depths aren't too deep, so you can put these foundations in, and the areas are pretty big. So I think they're definitely going to catch up. And especially since this first project is built, everyone's saying that the future projects will be less expensive. The power purchase agreements will probably be more favorable to ratepayers. So yeah, I think it's very promising. I think that they'll catch up pretty quickly.
And if we want to compare just wind farms to wind farms and not focus just on the offshore versus onshore, one of the advantages that the U.S. has is a lot of land. Some of the largest wind farms on the planet are actually in the United States. It's just we have a lot more empty space, shall we say, in the U.S. as they have in more densely right. populated countries like Germany and Denmark and the U.K.
Right, that's true. Because a lot of the properties where these massive the wind projects have been built in the Midwest and in Texas, they're on private property. And very quickly, they could see some cost benefit to these property owners. And so these projects have moved forward rapidly in the U.S.
Can you give us a snapshot of some of these wind farms that are not offshore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty much up and down the Midwest and even the West. I mean, I think there's a lot of these, every time if you go out and bus from the East Coast and you head west, you start seeing the more and more of these wind projects popping up. I don't know the size and scope of where and how they've been built, but I know, from Minnesota all the way down through Texas that they're really popping up in Iowa and Kansas and other states. I know the East Coast and the Northeast pretty well, where we have a lot less open space. And so you're seeing wind turbines built in these, one to two to three size projects.
The largest wind farm in terms of capacity, the largest offshore wind farm has a capacity of 630 megawatts, the London Array. And that pales in comparison to some of the larger ones that are being developed in China. The largest wind farm in the U.S. is called the Mojave Wind Farm. And that's in Kern County, California. It's also known as the Alta Wind Energy Center. And that has a capacity of 1,320 megawatts. So that's more than twice the capacity of the largest offshore wind farm in the world right now.
Yeah, I mean, some of these projects are really big. And that's why I think Texas and or California, I think their energy grid is, 10 to 20% that they're getting from wind energy. Maybe not quite 20, but their numbers are climbing. Whereas on the East Coast, it's, I think, less than 1% is coming from solar and wind combined. So, yeah, they've made a huge dent.
So you think the appetite for offshore wind fits a more densely populated coastal area like the East Coast than the West Coast? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I don't know all the problems with West Coast wind farms. I think that they do... I don't know if the wind is a little consistent. I know that the waters are a little deeper and that, for a lot of renewable energy projects, not always wind, but that the waters are a little rougher as well. So it makes construction and maintenance a little more difficult. But they don't, for some reason, the more ideal siting is on the East Coast, and particularly the Mid-Atlantic up to the north is where they seem to get the strongest and consistent winds.
Yes, the Obama administration has announced a lease for a wind farm off of the coast of Long Island recently, and then there's also talk of similar ones in Great Lakes regions. Do you think that these could still move forward under the new administration?
It's a lot of guesswork, but I think that the fact that they're creating jobs and, these numbers are growing up very quickly every year, just like solar has been in most recent years, that I think there will be enough lobbying. I think that there's the developers of these projects are they don't think they have any sort of political bias whatsoever. Certainly not. I haven't seen that towards the Obama administration. So I wouldn't think that these people who want to see these built, the developers in particular, would be adversaries of Donald Trump. And they'd be more inclined to, I think, have his ear on the fact that they're creating a lot of jobs and that it's saving businesses. It can, in the long run, will probably end up saving businesses money by having this, having these projects go forward. But then again, you're seeing already from his cabinet that there's a lot of fossil fuel interest there as well. So there might be some competing priorities as far as renewable energy goes.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the year. There's some pretty scary characters being assembled right now if you're somebody who cares about the environment.
Four strong winds that blow lonely, seven seas that run high, all those things that don't change come what may. But our good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I'm ever back this way. Think I'll go out to Alberta, weather's good there.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Tim Faulkner. He is the executive editor of EcoRI News. So Tim, getting back to the Block Island Wind Farm, it powers 17,000 homes, they say. But one of the negatives we've heard about wind power is intermittency. How will this project cope with intermittency? Is there decent storage capacity involved with this project, or is it only going to supplement homeowners' electricity when the wind blows? What happens when the wind isn't blowing?
Yeah, because this feeds just directly right into the power grid, there won't be any intermittency issues, especially even on Block Island. So Block Island will only... I guess maybe the disadvantage for Block Island is getting their electricity now from the mainland is that if there's a power outage on the mainland, they'll lose their power on Block Island. But if the wind stops blowing, you know, on these wind turbines, they're still going to get their electricity because it just feeds into the grid. And because wind is such a small percentage of the overall electric grid, that if the turbine stops spinning, it's not going to make a noticeable difference at all in the people's energy use and availability.
And do you have any information on comparing the costs for an offshore wind farm versus onshore? It would seem like these are significantly more expensive projects when you consider not only the complicated rules about who gets to build what on the seafloor, but then you also have the actual logistics of trying to put these turbines into the ocean.
Right. Yeah, I would say it's... certainly a lot more expensive. I mean, this is a $300 million project for these five turbines, which is a lot more than it would be to put up one or two turbines, which might be something, you know, less than $10 million to build that if you're going to build that, say, something in New England.
Really? Okay.
It's a lot. And being the first project, too, obviously, there's probably a lot more costs. And the electricity is a lot more expensive, too. I think if you're getting a power purchase agreement for onshore wind turbines, maybe it's around... 12, 15 cents that they might be getting for that electricity for a 20-year term, whereas this project is starting at 24 cents per kilowatt hour that the owners are going to get paid for these turbines, and that's going to go up 3.5% a year for 20 years. So it's pretty pricey electricity. I mean, I think that almost derailed the project a couple times in Rhode Island was the return that their investors are going to be getting from this power purchase agreement. But it's the first.
But you don't have the external costs of running toxic diesel fuel generators off of a pretty fragile ecosystem like Block Island, Rhode Island, right?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, there's definitely, I think the people in Block Island are really going to make out And if their electricity was probably 3 to 4 times what the average ratepayer pays in Rhode Island. So they're going to see a big savings right away.
And what'll it be now?
So they're going to pay the standard rate, which is right now about 8 cents per kilowatt hour. So, and they were paying, I think they had, they even had a surcharge, which I think was just 16 cents per kilowatt hour for getting that diesel fuel there. And then on top of it, it might've been another 15 cents or something like that. So they're going to see it at least cut in half and see that, that surcharge go away. So it's really going to be a benefit for them.
And so for people who own a home on Block Island, who may have thought that, oh, well, my view may reduce the value of my home, it would more than be offset by significantly less expensive and clean energy down the road, right?
Oh yeah, their savings will be big, definitely, for if you've got a especially if you're a year round resident there, definitely. So really, this power purchase agreement is going to be borne by the ratepayers of other Rhode Islanders, and that's where some of the objections to the project came up, especially from big electric users, big companies or manufacturers that use a lot of energy. They were probably most opposed to this project. For the average ratepayer, though, you're probably going to see, initially at least, your electric bill is going to go up about $1 a month just to pay for this project.
That's interesting. So there's some much less wealthy Rhode Islanders who are paying for some of these prime beach properties that Block Island homeowners have. So there's somebody who's living in relative poverty in Woonsocket or Pawtucket or in the tough part of Providence. They have to pay for some of these people who own million-dollar homes in Block Island.
That's right. Yep. There's definitely some social inequity, I think, to this power purchase agreement, especially for this project.
And when you talk about this $300 million cost, where is the bulk of that? Is it in the actually putting the turbines into the water, or is it paying for this footprint in the ocean, the power purchase agreement, as you mentioned?
It's the construction, the material. You know, you've got there's a lot of, one of the things that makes offshore wind a lot more challenging is that you don't have, the firm land to put your cranes and other stuff on. You've got to get these specialty boats and crews that come out. There's something called a jacklift boat, which is just like a giant barge that comes up. And this barge itself goes on these stilts, so it can go about 100 feet up in the air. And on top of that, you put a crane, a giant crane, so you can get this 600-foot turbine erected. So, try doing that in some pretty heavy ocean waters, and you can see that there's a lot of expenses and costs at risk there. And this project wasn't without its problems. There certainly were a fair amount of the kind of construction incidents and some damage to one or two of the turbines from barges bumping into them and having to get those repaired and other costs.
Does Rhode Island have any other offshore wind projects in the pipeline?
I think what we're looking at going forward is that some of these federal waters, these designated areas, are in waters that are in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And so the projects will probably be built in that area, and that they'll probably do some of their staging from Rhode Island and Providence. So I don't think there's anything specific like near Block Island or say off of Narragansett that's going forward. It looks like it's going to be in this designated federal area that's a little closer to Martha's Vineyard and to Nantucket. But Deepwater Wind is already looking at, I think, putting in another 15 turbines on top of two or three other developers that are looking at some bigger projects there.
He's the executive editor of EcoRI News, Tim Faulkner. Tim, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex. Anytime.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Jazz Crusaders, Cat Stevens, and the Chad Mitchell Trio.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.